Can I just talk about how much more professional the start of this podcast is just without JJ here and you running it, Laura?
Okay. Just she because I added a countdown?
She asked if we were ready, number one, and then she counted down and then she hit record. And I'm not saying, it's really to the audience to decide whether that is a feature or a bug of this, but it sure still seems professional. Right? Just calling it what it is.
Next we'll have theme music or something.
No.
I can or do like that.
A plan.
Can you play us in with your banjo, Laura?
I don't have a banjo. I could go try to make one, but that'd be funny.
Well, you could play the drums on your Hey, where are your Frisbees? What's going on?
Oh, it's just tilted down because my chair is like the little gas piston that helps it stay up is failing. So every time I'm sitting in a meeting, all of a sudden I just slowly start sinking. And you like
nothing is more demoralizing.
That's actually a thing that happens when you get old, Laura, is your gas piston starts failing.
Yeah. You have to wipe after farting now too. Nothing is as reliable as it once was.
Oh my god. Talk about totally like starting this podcast back up with a bang.
Yeah. So your chair sphincter is not as taut as it once was, is what I'm hearing.
Basically, yeah. So I've discovered that right now my chair is all the way down at the bottom and I just had no energy today to try to mess with it to get it to stay up. So I just instead tilted the camera. All of the Frisbees are still there. My last recording yesterday had all the Frisbees. I haven't changed any of the colors yet, though I really should.
All right.
So it's time to start changing.
Now as like a disc golf nerd, I'm just like, oh, I want to see all of your discs. like actually know what they do now. They're not just pretty little 10-inch, you know, circles behind you. I'm like, well, how far can I throw that one? What's its fade? What's its turn?
We're going to have to do like just one podcast going through the entire collection.
I feel like one we should one.
Like a video
like stream. For each of our obscure hobbies or semi-odd hobbies, we should take an entire episode to focus on it while other people just writhe in their seats. And
that matches the hallway track sometimes.
Yeah, just like I feel like a whole episode on bread baking, a whole episode on shit talking for Paul, a whole one on disc golf for us. Like, I think there's a there, as they say.
Yeah. Yeah. I could do one on just on running shoes, you know, because I've been going down the running shoe rabbit hole lately. So,
oh, let's talk about this. Now, I did notice, speaking of running shoes, that you're a fan of the old Energy toe socks.
With my picture about how I was in such a hurry that I shoved my foot in the sock wrong and ran with it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And everybody thought I dislocated my toe.
That's the one.
Whoops.
So how long have you been wearing the toe socks for?
On and off for about 2 years now for running.
Nice.
I have other socks, but I've just discovered they're so comfy and my toes never feel cramped and I have more energy to run. So
yeah, I agree.
Nice. I know blisters.
This is a thing.
I
need like at least a little pitch because this is I just think of it as like weird tech exec type wear, not normal people.
It's things. Not the rainbow toe socks that you know teenage girls wear or like the weird Vibram five finger like running shoe minimalist thing. No, so there's actually a brand of running socks that's for people, mostly it's like people doing marathons, stuff like that, but it's really common when you're doing longer distances that you get blisters in between your toes, your toes will cramp up or, you know, toenails getting really disgusting and black and falling off because of, you know, cramped shoes is actually really common. And one way to try to combat that is to actually wear these like socks, these toe socks for running. Inside of your like your normal running shoe, you're not wearing weird shoes to go with the socks. So I guess you could.
Yeah, no, I hear you.
Basic idea.
That's really smart. That's cool.
Yeah. So now I feel attacked because I wear my toe socks underneath my Vibram five finger shoes.
I mean, you can, you but I was weird. Assuming.
And then you put those into your running shoes, so you've got like triple protection against any sort of toe sprawl.
I don't mind toe shoes. It's just, I know there's quite a few like tech bro type folks that wear them as like their everyday wear.
Yeah, that's
more what I'm saying. Like if you have run in them and you've like worn yourself into that kind of a pattern, mm-hmm. and if you're not doing it for the fad, like it's actually a wonderful way to run. Absolutely. I can't do it because my knees can't handle it. But
yeah, it's definitely on harder surfaces like concrete and bitumen. It is definitely hard on your knees, but I tend to like walk and run more toe heavy than heel heavy anyway. And so that they kind of suit me more, you know, because traditional running shoes almost try and force you to land with your heel versus your, what's the thing at the front of your foot?
Ball of your foot?
Yeah, the ball, that's the word. Yeah. So they tend to suit like my running style a bit better. I need to get a new pair, and it's hard to find people that stock them anymore in Austin. Like I used to be able to just go to REI. And they have a tendency to refresh their models pretty frequently, and they always mess with the sizing when they redo the models. And so there's like two or three sizes I can be between depending on the particular model. So it's really difficult to buy them online, and you really need to try them on. That's frustrating.
Yeah, no, to change sizes between the same exact brand and footwear, like...
I mean, it kind of makes sense because they're so, like, they're meant to be completely basically fitted to your foot, right? And so any minor change then affects how it fits. And so you just have to kind of retry which one fits.
Do they have toe tailors? Like, is there like a subspecialty of people that will tailor those little toe shoes to your feet?
I mean, if you have, like, if you have enough money, you can find someone to do anything, right?
Yeah. I mean, you can actually buy minimalist shoes that they will fit to your foot. They're basically just like leather sheaths or the vegan leather sheaths of like, you send them the sketch of your foot and they go and they'll make it. I'm actually serious. There's some that do it where they make those, and then they also partner and do stuff for like Ren Faires and things like that, because they go and they make money at the Ren Faires doing like the handmade display, but they also make like real running shoes. I've seen those before.
Now I gotta say, lovingly hand stitching shoes is not a particularly fun activity.
It's a lot of work. Yeah,
it's a lot of work.
And I mean, your hands recommend. Ouchie. Yeah,
do not recommend.
They're not kidding when you're trying to stitch through leather.
Hey, so today is the 17th of March, and
it is.
Matt, I'm told that's a very special day for your people this year, so happy St. Patrick's Day.
Thank you. That is a very lovely misleading sentence, because it mixes up both the correct statement and a very different culture.
Right. So the real holiday I'm talking about, though, is Purim.
Purim.
Yeah. And I'm supposed to say Chag Purim Sameach. Yeah, no, I'm not going to do it.
Right. No, okay, you nailed it. No, that's exactly how every person who speaks Hebrew says it.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. I didn't know you'd look that up, but it's one of those rare moments, thanks to a lunar calendar meeting a solar calendar, where holidays overlap. And Purim, which is like in the fun way, it's like a Jewish Halloween party, like a masquerade party with a bunch of sugary foods, like a bunch of cookies are kind of key to it, and is landing on St. Patty's Day, which is kind of fun. Hmm. I guess you'd do like a green cookie would be the overlap,
I guess.
Yeah, but it's pretty fun. If our kiddo was older, we'd be going to like they're doing like a toddler dress up fair type thing, because it's really common to have like a full day of games, and it's a pretty cool little holiday in the middle of the year that most non-Jews have never heard of. So
speaking of kiddos, how is the little fella?
Yeah, Ada is good. She is a little over 2 months now, and is alternating between like adorable cherub baby and like a 100-year-old Jewish grandfather, depending on what angle you look at. and how sleepy she is. I'm like, Maris, is that you? No, Ada, it's still you. Okay, cool. And sleep is episodic. Last night was a light episode. Other nights have been really good. And it's just cool, man. She's starting to hold her head up. She smiles like crazy at me now and like started grabbing stuff. Like she'd like reach for my hand. And it's just one of the cooler things of my life.
That's really cool.
Yeah, thanks, man. Very not baby related, but you brought a, speaking of terrible transitions, you brought something up this week about Apple that I was interested in covering. This idea of when you leave, you become an associate.
Oh, that was, yeah, that was a while back. I guess our notes are pretty
old. We haven't really looked at the board in a while.
Yeah. Oh, cool, cool, cool. So
basically what that was, and I should probably look at the notes, but my remembrance of it is that when you leave Apple, they change your title to just be associate. And, you know, in theory, who cares? It doesn't matter, except when someone goes to do a reference check or, you know, something like that, they'll say, oh, was so-and-so a senior director of DevOps? And they're like, lol, no, they were an associate. And so like, what does that even mean? Especially because like associate software developer usually means like fairly junior in the rankings, right? And so right. It has a potential for really messing with people's career opportunities, which I think then obviously adversely affects people that are already challenged in that area because of their, you know, social standing, the, you know, where they grew up, how they grew up, you know, the color of their skin, you know, all sorts of things that already are disadvantages for people when looking for jobs and trying to get employment. I feel it like it's another thing that will unfairly disadvantage those people that already are, which is kind of shitty. Yeah. And there's not really any reason for it. Like, why? What's the point, Apple?
Because, well, Apple's weird.
Full stop. Yeah, no, that's an interesting one. I think it definitely takes more action to change somebody's title than to leave it. So right. There's some sort of system-based intention there. And what the intention of it is tough to read, but it sure doesn't look good.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, on the bright side, people do have Apple on the resume if they leave there, which
that's true.
Yeah.
Is like saying like, oh, I got a 2.0 at Harvard. No one's checking the 2.0 as often as you're looking at, oh, Harvard, you must be brilliant.
Yeah.
That's even true. Though that's highly correlative at best as well.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm glad I brought that up from the grave of what used to be our backlog, because it's just so interesting to know how systems work. One note in there that said, like, it makes a big difference at Apple if you're an L4 or an L5. And what I found is that most people, if I'm coaching them on career conversations, like the thing that surprises them the most is when I tell them like to be really curious and specific about what they want from their internal definition of rank, because that is that's what you're stuck with, man. If you're in a decent sized company, like you can't go, if you come in as an L2, even if you're as qualified as an L4, you can't just get there. Like the internal systems need you to progress through there in a very clear and process oriented way, regardless of skill, regardless of job title. So you got to know that system. Has that bitten either of you? Because it sure as hell bit me.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's bit me before, you know, going into a job, you don't quite know what level you're going into and you know, if you're if you start at a lower level than you really should be, it's then a huge uphill battle to try and catch up. And like, you have to catch up before you can even move forward. So if you end up, like if you should be a level 5 and you end up hired in as a level 4, then your next step to level 6 is actually now 2 steps away, right? And so when you put that against, you know, staff versus senior versus principal, et cetera, it, you know, makes it very difficult to get there. And so many companies have, you know, rules about, well, you have to have worked here for 2 years before you're even eligible for a promotion. And so now you've got minimum 2 years to even get right sized, you know. And then if you've ever tried to fight the HR machinery of a large company to get right sized out of band, it's like, it's easier just to quit. And I say that with all the privilege rehired in the world.
Well, quit and get rehired somehow magically. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Or just hired elsewhere. Yeah. Definitely within the privilege of, I don't know about you two, but it, in this industry right now, just seems like any amount of experience, like recruiters are just hitting you up on all platforms all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I guess for me, I find that they're all over the place because up until, you know, a few positions, like it's just strange because the smaller companies don't always have titles that make sense, right? And so, you know, you can be senior and it means nothing because they just gave that title to you because that was one way to get you to get hired versus giving you more money. So like at the smaller companies, you get that. So I get a huge range of junior developer advocate to head of developer relations to director developer relations. And like people are just pinging me just because that's something. And it's kind of it's an experience to say the least, to have that discussion with people when, you know, that they point out, oh, well, this person was a senior over here. And I'm like, do you know what that band actually means there?
Right.
And they go, no. And I'm like, well, then why does that mean anything to you?
If you don't know what it means, why does it mean anything to you is the perfect synopsis of that.
I mean, like, it's true. It's so true.
And at the same time, I have absolutely benefited from being specific about what job title I want.
Yeah.
Where like I put lead developer advocate on my job title in the past. And that's definitely the reason I got the opportunity to go for a director or a VP role. And it's one of those ones where the titles are both fine with being nonsensical and by default aren't important until they're important, until they're signifiers of what you are should or shouldn't be qualified for, allegedly.
Yeah, I regret not pushing that way because it's very easy to get missed. So.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. Fair.
So how is the weather for everybody? I know how the weather is for you, Laura, because it's the same as it is for me.
Considering you're not that far from me.
Right. So I will say I was just in I was on vacation in Oaxaca in Mexico City, and it was actually very warm. And a few days it was actually almost uncomfortably warm, especially because a lot of places are not air conditioned. So pro tip, when you're letting friends book an Airbnb, don't just trust that they know to make sure that the place is air conditioned.
Yeah, that'll get you.
Yeah. Yeah. Which, I mean, I say that, and that's mostly in jest. Like the places we had were actually quite nice. There were fans and everything, and it wasn't oppressively hot. And it was the kind of hot where it cools down at night. So, you know,
okay,
that's not actually a problem. But well, at the same time, it is.
Well, let's kind of earmark this Oaxaca conversation because yes. I want to hear more about that. But weather-wise, Minnesota is on a hot streak by our definition. It's been over 40 for multiple days now.
There you go.
This is nice. The fall spring. Mm-hmm. That we had a swimming pool size amount of snow melt in the front yard and backyard, as you do. But it's a great reason to dust off the grill. And I already did like the indirect smoking of a big fillet of trout for the first time of the year, and I just really missed eating outside or being outside to cook it. We didn't eat outside yet, but yeah, it's I'm back, bitches.
Nice. Yeah, so I was gonna say the day I got back from Oaxaca, which was Saturday, it was like 40 degrees here in Austin. It was actually, I think it actually got to freezing, right, Laura?
It was. I was doing a panel for South By on Friday, and we were bundled up in ski jackets and wool coats and everything, and the wind chill was like 20 something.
Mm-hmm.
that's all in Fahrenheit, obviously. But yeah, it was like 20 something Fahrenheit. It was very cold. I was not pleased because, well, the whole event was outside. So because it's Austin and it's March and it's fine. And we're like, you should have known better.
Yeah. And then on Sunday it was 80 degrees again. So it was, you
know, exactly. We were so the sacrifice perfect to the weather gods.
Yeah. And so like I've been going out in the evenings for a run or a walk or whatever. And sort of, you know, back to the Austin, you know, shorts and tank top kind of thing. And it's quite pleasant.
That's beautiful.
Well, I'm just going to rub it in, Matt. Just rub it
Yeah, no, it's bit. Fine. This is basically our tank top weather. I went outside, it hit 50, and there are a bunch of people in shorts and t-shirts. And I kid you not, like, that's just the energy here. So gotta accept the good with the bad. I think that's good. But let's get back to Oaxaca, because that sounds incredible. Like, tell us about the food you ate and like the region you were in, because I've never made it out that direction.
Yeah, so flew into Oaxaca, spent I think 6 days, and then we did like 4 days in Mexico City, and we basically just ate our way through Oaxaca, ate all the foods, ate all the moles. We did a mole class where we basically learned how to make that famous Oaxacan black mole.
Yeah, amazing.
We ate at a couple of like really nice Oaxacan restaurants, one of which, and if I had thought about this, I would have remembered the names and pronunciations to write them down, but whatever. I can maybe put them in the show notes. One of them, the real standout, was at this place where like they're not, you basically have to call and make a reservation. And we were the only ones there, and it was four of us. And basically they're cooking from like basically all the stuff is coming from a small town in the region, and so it's all grown in the farms there, all the proteins, all the vegetables, and basically it's all just like ultra seasonal. And so, and it was all on the traditional wood-fired clay cooking oven thing. So basically it's like a clay oven with a flat top, and the flat top is basically what you cook everything on, right? Huh. And so there's a fire inside of it. It's hot, and so, you know, she was doing everything from like hand rolling the tortillas. So she had masa that she had like hand ground on those, you know, the roller grinders that they use. And she'd actually done two different types of corn, so it was like half yellow, half blue. And she would just sort of grab a small bit of each and then kind of hand form the tortillas and then put them straight on the flat top cooker thing.
Badass.
That was so good.
I'm assuming so you didn't make that squealing noise like when you were doing the tortilla press.
Not the same noise with the tortilla press, because they're not forcing the air out the same way.
Yeah, that's true. That's fair.
And so that was an incredible meal. I bet. And every meal we had there was incredible, right? But that was definitely the standout. We had a lot of, clearly we had a lot of tacos, had a lot of al pastor, which is kind of my favorite kind of taco. While we're in Mexico City, we found a place that did really good cochinita pibil. We found some really good seafood places, both in Oaxaca and Mexico City. And probably the best seafood meal we had was in Mexico City. And then amusingly, our last night, in Mexico City, we didn't want to have anything super like spicy or anything, because, you know, we were flying the next day, and so we went to a Uruguayan restaurant and basically had like steaks and chimichurri and but basically stuff cooked on the grill kind of stuff, and that was all pretty delicious too. And obviously we were in Oaxaca, so we did a mezcal tour, and the guy took us to like basically the best mezcal place first. And so we went to the other one, which actually I think was good, right?
Yeah, you can enjoy the first.
Yeah, it was amazing. We went to the second one and we're like, oh, this is fine, but like, can we go back to the first place? And then actually because of that, we're like, well, do we want to go to two more places that are, you know, meh compared to the first place? Not really. So we then hijacked him and said, can we go do some other stuff? So we went and looked at the Alabrije. I'm saying that wrong, but it's basically a like a hand wood carved and painted little statues and figurines and stuff. And like the process is phenomenal. Like it takes 4 months to create this tiny little thing.
What?
Because, like it's a super soft wood they use. So they've got like the master carver is carving like it into like animals, cats and elephants and monkeys and whatever, right? Anything. Ooh. From a couple of inches tall to like 6 foot tall. And then they have to like dry it. And they also have to treat it, right? So they soak it in basically gasoline for like several weeks at a time. And they do that two or three times just to make sure there's no living things or larvae of living things in it. And then when they're done with that, they like let it dry out fully, which takes, again, months. And as it dries out, it cracks. And so you end up with all these cracks. And so they have to repair the cracks. And so they repair the cracks by using the offcuts and shavings that they have, you know, cut off it while they've been carving it. And they sort of open the gap even more. And they basically jam bits of wood into the gap, break it off, sand it down, and then use like a combination of wood shavings and glue to like cover it up. And then they sand it, and then they give it a coating, and then they sand it, they give another coating, they sand it.
Wow.
And then finally they start painting it. And like the painting is like super intricate. And like it's unbelievable that like super, like really amazing, like geometric patterns. But it's all completely hand done just by like one person and a paintbrush. And the same person does the whole piece. And so it can be a couple of days for a small piece. It can be months for a big piece. And you know, the guy said basically, if the master painter for a big piece takes a week off, then the piece takes a week off as well. And so just because, you know, a lot, I guess for the smaller stuff, a lot of that months is actually just like waiting for it to dry and stuff. But for the larger pieces, literally a person will be painting it every day for 6 months straight, this one piece.
Wow. Huh. That is wild,
right?
That's really cool.
Yeah, and it is really cool. And of course, you know, they're like small family run workshops, sort of 30 minutes drive away and stuff. So yeah, so we looked at that. We went to one of those places. We went to a couple other, like there's a black pottery is another thing that's a thing they do over there. So we went and looked at some of that. And it was kind of nice to take a break from the mezcal and see a bit of, you know, cultural type stuff.
That sounds awesome. I'm glad you had a good adventure there.
Yeah, and of course it was all muted because, you know, I'm trying to be on vacation while also being cognizant that I have friends that are huddled in their basements as bombs are dropping on their heads. So, you know, there's only so much, you know, it's one thing to be on vacation enjoying yourself, but, you know, the last thing I wanted to be doing is like posting stuff and rubbing it in people's faces that I'm carouseling about on vacation while they're literally their homes have been destroyed. So that definitely had a very weird mood.
Yeah, that's a tough juxtaposition, especially with it hitting so close to home for you. Yeah. Well, I'm so glad you went. It sounded absolutely wonderful. But other things I wanted to follow up on, like, how was South By, other than freezing your tush off? Like, was it fun to be DevRelling there? Like, I guess I don't think of that as a classic enterprise technology conference.
So this was my first South By. I've never been to South By before, even though I've lived here like 8 years or so. And it was, I found out that there are lots of adjacent events that aren't officially sanctioned South By events, but you know, they're happening at the same time and they're using the same hashtags and all that. So this was by the GAN Hub, the Global Accelerator Network group. And they did an entire day, entire weekend of like DevRel community type focus stuff for startups. So like just walking through all of it. So I was there for about a day. I couldn't make it to the whole hub, which is 3 days long. So I went there for the first day and it was interesting. I think it probably was the best way to meet, to like kind of get contacted by a lot of people, because a lot of people were in such a hurry. They were like, hey, I want to talk to you more about that, but here's my business card. Let's catch up later. And so I have this like little stack of business cards. I'm like, that's fine. I don't have to
people. Quaint.
I can just get business cards. Okay. This is a little weird, but all right. I still have lots of random people finding me on LinkedIn, sending me messages, you know, doing the whole, like, I'm sending you a random connection and you don't know who I am, kinds of things. But I mean, I didn't really get to see the main festival. I didn't have to go downtown. It was in East Austin instead of in Central Austin. So I didn't have to deal with a lot of that mess. And it was right near the train station for the light rail. So I could just hop on the light rail and do that kind of quick trip into downtown type scenario, which was nice. Oh, pardon me. Yeah, but I don't really know that I would say South by is a DevRel world. Like, I know there's panels that you can do and stuff like that for the interactive, but
yeah,
you know,
okay,
the adjacent that stuff sounds okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like South by is basically like the Reddit of real life, of like there's a bunch of sub events going on in all directions, and your overall experience only depends on like where you subscribe, because like there's too much to be a part of all at once.
Though I will say that the one thing that everybody's remembering is the gigantic QR code that somebody made out of drones to hang over downtown in the middle of South by. We were horrified.
Kind of badass.
I mean, it was impressive on one level, and on the other level, everybody's just like, okay, so how long is it going to be before you have to pay money to not have ads across your night sky? Like, there were jokes like that flying around, and that was not a pun about drones, but it could be with them flying around. But yeah, so I think like that kind of part of the experience everybody sees. But yeah, I don't know. For $1,500 per lanyard, this was free. But then the actual main event is like $1,500. I don't think I'd ever want to do it.
Fair. Very fair.
Meh. Maybe I'm a curmudgeon. I don't know. But no.
It would be interesting to see the statistics on how many people actually scanned the airborne QR code. And if you had access to a fleet of cheap drones and were able to recreate that and then like redirected all these people to some site that's going to hack their phones and install malware and stuff, it would be kind of an interesting experiment. It's like a super modern version of the, you know, drop a CD or a USB key in the parking lot of a, you know, office.
Yeah. Have you ever seen the USB keys that people have built into like retaining walls and buildings and stuff? Have y'all never seen those? They're like, I forget what they call them. It's like something drops and people put them there. I don't know if they honestly expect people to like plug into it, but it used to be that they were like geocache drops with like cool images or a new song by some local artist or something. But of course, like, you can't prevent people from putting whatever they want on there.
Right.
And you're building it into your building. You can't remove it without taking apart the wall and re-putting it back together. So I always wondered about those. So it kind of makes it like this QR code idea kind of feels like the temporary version of that. And I'm sure there were studies done on those about what weird security hack you can do with somebody's
stuff. Speaking of QR codes, I did... And this was a while back I found out about it, but probably the best use of QR codes ever is, I don't know if Apple does it as well, but on an Android phone, you can, if you want to give someone access to Wi-Fi, you can just open your current Wi-Fi connection and hit share and it will pop up a QR code. And anyone with any phone or iPad or anything can scan that and just automatically connects into the Wi-Fi. So you're no longer having to like read out the password and remember which and characters, no, which numbers. B, exactly.
@
Yeah.
Exclamation. Yeah, exactly. It's but so nice. It is, those are the moments where I appreciate QR codes. Not to brag, but Apple probably stole that idea, which isn't the brag part, and just made it better, where like if any Apple device is trying to log into your network and that person is in your contacts, it'll pop up on your phone saying, do you want to share the password? You click yes, and they are automatically logged in on all their devices.
Yeah.
So
it's just so much easier. I don't know.
It's time. It's time for things to suck less. Yeah. Really, really nice features. I think it's been a long week. It's been a long
couple weeks. Long month.
So
long everything.
Send in everybody listening to this. I hope we gave you some entertainment for a bit, and that you are doing what you need to get some self-care in between the day job and the news, and limiting the latter and the former as much as you can. Do you want to round it out with some food?
We can round it out with food like we normally do. That's fine. I don't have any new news on food. Oh, wait, I do have new news on food. It's not for this weekend, but I made a diner style omelet for the first time. It was a horrible mess. It was very tasty, but I cannot figure out how to get like the directions for how to make this kind of an omelet is like, you're supposed to pull the curds in as they keep getting more and more done, and you're supposed to swirl the pan to get the egg in the extra spaces, but they don't really explain like, when do you stop doing that so you don't end up with like weird holes in your round omelet-ish shape thing. So I made a bacon, asparagus, and Gruyere and shallot omelet. It was delicious, but it looked like I have no clue what I'm doing, which is basically about true, but it was delicious. I don't care. So
yeah, this is a good thing about things like omelets and stuff, like as long as it's mostly cooked and you know, so it's delicious.
Yeah, I mean, a ugly omelet is called a hash, and
yeah,
that's great. If you have some potatoes on the side, just toss it in with it, you're good.
Yeah, the interesting, I don't know if I could call it a hack, but like the proper way to do it that I didn't know, because I've made omelets a lot. It's just, you know, I'll have all the ingredients done, and then I toss it into the center of the omelet with the cheese at the end, and then flop it over, and I'm good to go. But this time they had me do the bacon in the pan, then put the asparagus and the shallots in there. Then you take it out, but you put it into the bowl with the cheese and mix it all together. And then wipe out the pan, start cooking the eggs and get it flat, and then put everything back in. The cheese melting in with the hot ingredient, like the hot stuffing ingredients, was the game changer. Because normally, like, I can never get it finished enough so that the cheese actually melts. Instead, it's just this kind of like, you get like the stringy bits of cheese in there, and it's like, nah, that doesn't taste great. So anyway, it was delicious.
Way to go.
So food.
Yeah. I love it.
Y'all probably have done so much more of these omelets than I have, but I was just really proud of myself for doing it at least once or twice actually now. So
I was a deli, like a diner-ish line cook for years, I think. I've probably made thousands of omelets. It was French toast, omelets, pancakes, breakfast sandwiches. I've only learned to cook because of Paul a couple years ago. But like before that, like I could make any breakfast food, and that was my comfort zone. I could just like, yeah. I would make omelets for my friends in college all the time, and they thought it was so fancy. I'm like reliving some very foundational memories of like, why can't I get this omelet to look pretty? Why can't I get the ingredients to cook at the same temperature? And I'm like, all the things you're saying really resonated.
Yeah.
Laura, if you want to go to hard mode, you want to make a tornado omelet?
What's a tornado? Okay, I gotta know what a tornado omelet. I've made French omelets. I'm actually pretty good at those. I make Unda style omelets, which is where I put the tortilla on top and use that as the fold. It's delicious. But I have never heard of a tornado omelet.
Yeah. So it's kind of, I don't know. I think it came out of Japan originally, but it's also a thing in Korea. And basically you whisk the eggs like a lot, and then you cook them in a nonstick pan. And the idea is, as the bottom starts to set, you use a pair of chopsticks to pull two edges in, and then you start spinning it. And so basically the omelet kind of lifts up on itself and twists on itself. And so you end up with what looks like a tornado like shape. And the trick is like you cook it until it's like still just a little bit soft on top. And then you often will drape it over the top of something. So it's one of the ways of doing omurice is you would then drape that whole thing over like a little mound of fried rice or whatever.
Yeah.
So I will admit the one comfort food that I haven't made in a really long time, but if you're listening and looking for like really weird comfort foods, eggs and egg noodles, scrambled eggs and egg noodles. It's really good. Don't bury it unless you try it. Like it's like eggs and rice, except with egg noodles. It's really good. But this makes me think of that, 'cause I would like put the omelet on top of egg noodles in my head. So
in the omelet category, there's a Chinese comfort food dish that's basically eggs and tomatoes, which is like, it's not quite an omelet, it's not quite a stir fry, it's basically you cook the egg and then you kind of break it up, and then you cook the tomatoes, and then you kind of add the egg back in, and then you add a bunch of like Shaoxing wine, you add some white pepper, you add usually some MSG and a couple of other seasonings. And it's quick and it's delicious. And you have like, if you have some leftover rice or something, it sort of makes a really easy thing you can kind of eat.
Yum.
And it's a good kind of side dish if you're making a bunch of like Chinese food or something and you just kind of want to like round it up and have a few more things. But the thing I was thinking of talking about is I made some chicken soup on Sunday, I think it was. And basically I took a whole chicken, cut it into quarters, and then basically simmered it in water with some aromatics, some celery, onion, carrot. And then basically as the chicken cooks, I would take it out, pull the bones off and put it back in. So sort of half an hour in, I took the breasts out, took the meat off, put the bones back in. Another half hour in, I did the same with the thighs. And at that point, I then also took the vegetables out because they'd kind of softened up and released any flavors. And you don't want the vegetables to get too soft or they start breaking up and then make the broth murky. And so that kind of made the base for the soup. And then when I was ready to actually eat it, I then basically brought it back to a simmer, added some more vegetables just till they were cooked, added some chicken back in, and boom, it was ready. But then I had a bunch of leftover chicken, and so last night for dinner I made a really quick chicken Alfredo. And that was basically just like a handful of pasta. It was like probably 150 grams with about double that of chicken stock and milk, which I used the soup, and just didn't throw any of the veggies from the soup in. And you basically cook that until like the water is almost all gone and the pasta is al dente. Then threw in a splash of heavy cream. I added some paprika and like a couple other things like that. And then added in some diced chicken and kind of gave it a toss, and it's kind of done. Tasty, awesome. Delicious, filling, and like basically a good leftover meal, right? Because there's nothing there you don't have in your pantry and or, you know, leftovers.
Exactly. Yeah, that's resourceful. I love those. Like when you just have stuff left over and it turns into a great meal, which that's exactly why I made I'm probably going to pronounce it wrong, so correct me if you know it better, but nok cham, the fish sauce based salads, the Vietnamese food, I believe by default. Is where it comes from. And it's really just like you can grab a recipe off New York Times if you're into it, or just search for Walk of Life. But it's like a fish sauce heavy sauce with lime juice, like some simple syrup in there, and like something spicy to the degree you can hang with. Mm-hmm. I skipped most of the spice for the sake of my person who is also going to eat this. So I used just red pepper, so you still had something crunchy and zesty. And then a little bit of some like jalapeno hot sauce I had just to give a little zing. And you roll basically leftover chicken, like a few chicken thighs, a few drumsticks, just shredded that, warmed it up, and added it with a bunch like cabbage, some arugula and mint and sweet basil is most of it. And it just turns into like this really sweet and savory, absolutely delicious salad that I tend to serve over white rice and, you know, the side of sake. And it's very tasty. It's like such a good go-to. If you have the greens on hand, it's like trivial to do. And if you don't, you feel like, what the hell do I have to buy at the store? It's just so many random little things, but turns into a really good meal.
Sounds like it.
Sounds pretty delicious. Now, there was one thing you said that made me think of something else. And I think it's a request we'll give to JJ. What was the hot sauce you used?
I just used a jalapeno hot sauce from... So it's
funny, when you said that, I heard jalapeno. And my immediate thought was like challah bread with jalapenos through it.
Oh my God. Oh, like a jalapeno would be... Amazing. That actually sounds really good.
So I bet if you put a bit of cheddar through it as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's got to be cheddar to balance it out.
Yeah.
If you like sauteed the jalapenos first to like give them a little bit, I don't know. I think it just adds some better flavor to it. And like, I don't know how an egg.
A little
bit. Yeah, exactly. I feel like there's just something about like really fresh jalapeno and bread is can be pretty intense. You got to like bake it or saute it or something. That's awesome. I want that.
That's what we're gonna ask JJ to make for us.
There we go.
Jalapeno. Is this JJ's our calling? Homework. Like punny foods?
Of
like...
course.
Okay, folks. If you can think of a punny food that one of us should make, we will follow through on it if the pun is sufficient.
Yeah, the pun has to be good. The pun has to be either really good or really bad.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But...
It's kind of bad that we're like, oh, okay, you win. Like that kind of bad.
So. Exactly. Yeah, quality is a loop in that way. Like both ends go towards winning. Well, that's a lovely thing to wrap up on, if you all agree. Thank you all for listening. We missed you, JJ, even though I poked fun at you at the beginning.
Yeah.
I'll give him a compliment to end. He's getting way better at chess and is close to beating me. We drawed for the first time and I can't beat him in 4 moves or 10 moves like I used to. Like Wait. It's hard to win.
So is he getting better or are you getting worse?
Both are very possible.
I was going to say, you're also sleep deprived.
So JJ is looking better. I'll just say that.
There we go.
So with that, miss you all. Bye. Hope to see you. Stay safe. Bye.
Bye.